This is a really difficult thing to write about. I mean, the example that you used here, one of the examples
Wait
anyway,
a second.
Brock Turner.
Question?
Yeah, sure.
Why is it difficult to write about?
I feel it's difficult because of the climate that we are in and the difficulty I have faced, frankly, in finding a way to get at the idea that if you talk about sexual assault in this way in the context of alcohol, some will say, wait a minute, we don't want to give people like Brock Turner a pass and just say, oh, he was drunk and he wouldn't have done this if he weren't drunk.
Why does that give him a pass?
I don't know. I don't know why that would...
It's the opposite. It's like, dude, you made a decision to go crazy that night with alcohol. You need to own up to the consequences. Nobody made you drink that much. You did, right? And you are just in the same way. No one... The observation that someone who is drunkenly driving, we don't use the fact of their inebriation as an excuse. No, we hold them accountable. Like... This is, sorry to jump on you on this, but so much of people's hesitancy to tackle really crucial topics right now is based on a fantasy about how those comments will be received. I don't think people will jump to this conclusion having read that chapter. I don't think it's tricky to talk about the role of alcohol. I think it's really straightforward. You get wasted. Bad things happen. Like, that is the most kind of straightforward common sense, and you are responsible for your decision to get wasted, and so you need to be, you know, we can't go around inhibiting what we're willing to say, particularly as journalists, based on fears about how it will be received. Like, that's an abnegation of, if we have one responsibility as journalists, it is to tell people what we believe to be true, right?
Certainly, yeah. Well, I was curious about what kind of conversations you may have had with your editor about that part. Was it a well-discussed subject?
The one thing I will say in support of your comment is that there is a way to have written that chapter such that it would legitimately have been perceived as victim blaming or excusing. So I had to be very careful that I didn't write it in that way.
That's what I mean it's tricky. You don't want to say something that is... There are, rightfully so, a lot of sensitivity around this subject. And you, as a writer, have to imagine all the possible people out there who may feel this more strongly than someone like me, who had never experienced sexual assault. So I would not experience this chapter in the way that someone who has had that experience.
Yeah, you... There's a line you have to walk, and you can't wander on either side of the line. Mm. And so I did go. I rewrote that chapter more than any other chapter in the book, and I put together a panel of 21-year-old women and had them read it and give me comments. And, you know, so you got to be careful, because you're right, it's tricky, but I don't think, but it's not impossibly tricky.
No, you just pulled it off. I mean, well, I'm curious now, what were some of the comments you received from that panel? Do you remember?
Well, actually, you know, it was actually a really, really, really interesting exercise, because one of the things you discover, so you know, as someone who, any journalist knows this, that your first, second, third, fourth, and fifth drafts typically do not represent what you believe. In other words, the reason you write is both to figure out what you believe and also figure out how to write what you believe. And it takes a while. So what happened, what was really interesting, was I wrote an early draft of that chapter, and I gave it first to my assistant, who was a 23-year-old woman, just recently graduated from college. And she pointed out all the different ways in which my male biases were on display. And without meaning to, the early draft probably did veer on out of, into the bad area of that line. And she pointed out to me, and had I not given it to her, I wouldn't have seen it. And so it alerted me to the fact, like, even under the best of intentions, you cannot, without help, escape your biases, right? And it's a, all writers know this, but we tend to forget it from time to time. And it's really, really useful to be reminded of the fact that bias is real, and if you're writing about these kinds of cases, you will write it from the perspective of your gender first. And that's not necessarily what you want to write, but that's just how it begins. So I was, those are the things, and these aren't sort of macro things, they're just kind of choice of language, it's emphasis, it's all kinds of the way the argument flows, the, like just kind of little, because when, little kind of nuancy things, and I think that I corrected most of those in that chapter. I don't have any anxiety about that chapter being misperceived. Mm-hmm.
Well, while we're on the heavy stuff, I want to ask you about the chapter you wrote about Jerry Sandusky. Mm-hmm. And I think for me reading that, the focus was more on the people who had suspicions or people who thought they saw something. And the chapter seemed to be trying to figure out what level of culpability those people had. What's your thinking on those people? I mean, there are various different stories, but where did your thinking land?
My inclination is that the decision made by the prosecutors in the Penn State, so this is, we're referring to this notorious case of a couple years ago when a football coach at Penn State was found to be a serial child molester. And having, after sort of years and years and years of predation, he's finally caught and convicted and put in jail, whereupon the prosecutors turn their attention to the leadership of Penn State and prosecute the leadership as well, including the president of the university. And my focus in the chapter is, was it appropriate to also pursue criminal charges against the leadership of the school? In other words, can you hold people in positions of, under what circumstances can you hold people of positions of authority responsible for not understanding the strangers in their midst? And a pedophile is a classic definition of a stranger. A pedophile is someone who expends an enormous amount of effort and ingenuity on hiding their dark impulses from those around them, right? They wake up and they spend their entire day thinking about this problem. How can I pursue my desires without getting caught? So, you know, can we blame people in positions of authority if they fall prey to that deception? And my conclusion was, in the specific instance of Penn State, I think not. I think it was a travesty to go after the leadership of Penn State. In the case of Larry Nassar in Michigan State, I think the opposite. I think that the evidence was clear enough that they ought to have acted way sooner. But those are very, very different kind of cases. But I think it's important, though, to understand that once it is a dangerous road to get on to start acting in a punitive way towards those who are the victims of deception. So do you put the victims of Bernie Madoff in prison for being fooled by Madoff? The parents, in the case of Larry Nassar, many of the parents of the young girls who were being abused by Larry Nassar were in the room while their children were being molested. In the room. And there's a famous instance where one of the mothers observed that as Larry Nassar was treating her 11-year-old daughter, he had an erection. She saw the erection. And then she saw him put his fingers inside her daughter's vagina. She was a medical doctor. She did nothing. Do you put her in jail? No, you don't. Why don't you put her in jail? Because you understand that the complex psychological mechanisms that all of us have that make it very hard for us to reach that kind of conclusion about a stranger, right? We default to truth. We want to believe the best. She explained it away, as one does, because to acknowledge that you had allowed your daughter to be treated by a pedophile, I mean, the enormity of that is overwhelming, right? So what is the appropriate attitude to have towards the parent in that instance? To have compassion for the parent. They have to live with that fact every day for the rest of their lives. But you don't put them in jail for negligence, right? And you also understand that, oh my God, there but for the grace of God go I. We are conditioned as human beings to be, I mean, the mountain climber was fooled by, the savviest, most brilliant guy in the world was fooled by we can easily be fooled. And to pretend that somehow being fooled is evidence of venality or negligence or incompetence is just crazy. Mm-hmm. So I think we need to be really, really, really careful, and we need to have compassion for the victims of deceivers, as opposed to being filled with this kind of self-righteousness.
You write here, especially with respect to Penn State and the president of Penn State, Graham Spanier, that we want someone who defaults to truth in that case, mm-hmm. if they are running a huge university and trying to treat their employees well. We don't want someone like Harry Markopoulos. We don't you want don't. A holy fool.
Can you imagine having a president of your university who was Harry Markopoulos, who suspected everyone of wrongdoing, who was following you as you left the cafeteria to make sure you didn't pocket any utensils? I mean, yeah. That's not what you want, right?
Right. That would be ridiculous. But I also thought, like, all right, who would I, let's say, is it, the question I had is it different if children are involved? Like, let's say I am a parent, I'm not a parent, but let's say I was, and I had to leave my child with someone. Mm-hmm. And I had two choices. I had Graham Spanier, who is default to truth, and who may trust anybody who also comes up to my child while they are in this person's care. Or would I give my child for a weekend to Harry Markopoulos, and hypothetically, and Harry Markopoulos is not gonna trust anyone near my kid. And for a weekend, I gotta say, I'd probably go with Harry Markopoulos.
Are you serious?
Well.
Oh my God.
It's probably a good thing that I'm not a parent, but Harry Markopoulos is not gonna let anyone near my kid. And I want my kid
Why
to be in one piece when I get back.
Why don't you lock your kid up in the basement if you're so concerned?
Let's just say if I had that terrible binary choice over the weekend, because I want my kid to be safe, and I don't want someone who is so defaulting to truth, for someone to say, "Hey, I've got some candy in my van. Let me borrow your kid for a moment."
No, like, so let's reword that question, because
okay,
I think that you've given us
maybe this is an extreme example, but I often wonder, like,
you've given us not a very useful hypothetical.
Okay.
If I might be so. There is a middle ground, a reasonable middle ground. So why do, when you go to the dentist and the dentist puts you under before a root canal, there is always a second person in the office. Here are the nurses. They'll always have a nurse present or a dental assistant present. Why is that? Because years and years ago, there were a series of cases in which people came to believe, rightly or wrongly, that while they were under a general anesthetic, the dentist had abused them, right? So what dentists said quite reasonably was, 99.999% of us do not sexually abuse our patients while they're under general anesthetic. But let's just take a reasonable precaution, and let's just say to the hygienist, why don't you just come into the office with me while I'm putting someone under general anesthesia, so that you can say, if this charge is ever levied, that actually, no, I was there the whole time. It's fine, right? It's a very simple way to resolve this. We haven't turned patients and dentists into paranoid Harry Markopouloses. We've just had a very simple hack which resolves the issue. There are other ways to do it. You don't have to suspect your financial advisor, every financial advisor, of being a Madoff-level fraud, but you can do something as simple as not give your money to a guy who can't explain his trading strategy. Seems reasonable. Or if your financial advisor returns a 12% return year in, year out, regardless of the state of the markets, you might want to ask yourself whether it's real, right? You don't have to be Harry Markopoulos. You just want to say, well, you know, if my financial advisor defies the laws of physics year in, year out, I might want to open a Schwab account and go somewhere real, right? So there's a middle ground here where we just act. And I think what most productive parents do is occupy that middle ground, right? They don't suspect the Boy Scout leader of being a pedophile, but they do go with their kid one day to the Boy Scout thing. And if they see that, oh, there's like three people with the kids at all times, and they think, okay, it's fine, mm-hmm. right? So I think those are appropriate steps that we can take. So in other words, we can acknowledge the fact that I can't look into the heart of the dentist or the Boy Scout master or the, I can't know for certain whether they are this rare example of a deviant or a deceiver. But what I can do is take a reasonable precaution that allows me to sleep well at night, and I can leave my fundamentally trusting nature intact. And more than that, I can allow my children to grow up with a fundamentally trusting nature. Because if your kid grows up to be like Harry Markopoulos, your kid is going to grow up unhappy, right? And I think the fundamental role of a parent is not, as you said, to keep your children safe. It is to keep your children happy. I mean, I'm not a parent either, but so.
Two non-parents talking about parenting right now.
We're two guys arguing.
Sorry, everybody. we can talk after the show.
About this thing called kids.
About how much we do not know about which we speak.
I understand they're like smaller. I don't know how they work exactly, but
I owe everybody here an apology. So here's an example I wanted to run by you, because you can help us sort of think a little bit more practically about figuring out the intentions of the person, the stranger before us. So let's say you're dating, right? You're dating someone, and the person you're dating is relatively new to you, and you sit down for a conversation over coffee or whatever, and this person confesses to you and says, "Look, the past two or three, we'll say for this example, three. The past three people I've been in a long-term relationship with, I have cheated on. I am incredibly remorseful over it, and I'm never going to do it again." And from where you sit, this person confessing this to you looks really remorseful about it.
This is not a first date?
No. Let's say it's not a first date.
I was going to say, you must have very different experience of first dates than I do.
No, this is totally hypothetical as well.
So
this person has, on the one hand, sort of made a confession that maybe if they didn't, you'd never know. But also, if you looked at them on paper and you had this stat in front of you, that would give you pause. So how do you evaluate, how do you weigh the resume, so to speak, versus the remorse that you think you see and the demonstration of honesty in front of you? How would you go about weighing that?
Jennifer Fugati in the audience would tell you, if we asked her, she would ask the question, what does remorse look like? So all of us have a notion of what it means to be remorseful, but if you actually interrogate that notion, you'll discover that there is no signature set of facial expressions that signal remorse. Remorse is an incredibly amorphous emotion. And secondly, to the extent we can identify what remorse looks like, we have no reason to believe that a remorseful look matches a truly remorseful feeling on the inside. So if someone looks remorseful in this context, there's no reason to believe them. And if they have a long track record of cheating, I suppose common sense would say, what's the expression? Walks like a duck.
Or maybe a leopard doesn't change his spots, so to speak.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's a number of, I think, useful
good
cliches
expressions
that could be employed to clarify the situation. But I would be more concerned about, I'm intrigued by the notion that the person's telling you that they've cheated on their last three. I just find that kind of fascinating. I would be so in awe of, like, whoa, like, you're willing to tell that? Like, is that in your, match.com profile? under personal interest, cheating on significant others, feeling bad afterwards.
I would like to transition from cheaters to presidential candidates, because we in New Hampshire, we have access to them here in New Hampshire, and we see them up close, and we try our best to sort of read their expressions and their tones of voice when they are here talking to New Hampshire voters. But they also have a resume. They have a vote. A lot of them do. A lot of them have a voting record. A lot of them have a history that we can sort of scrutinize. Mm-hmm. And so do we kind of use that same evaluative muscle when we're looking at these presidential candidates? I mean, should we stop going to these events because they don't mean anything and just like look at how they voted on congress.gov or something like that?
Totally. I mean, the one thing we should not do is conduct debates and judge them on the basis of how they perform in a debate. Like, that's absurd. The job of being president of the United States is not based on your ability to shine in a multi-person debate under the lights in front of a inquisitor from CNN. I mean, it's the most contrived, like, rule number one of picking someone for a job is the criteria you use to judge them on should match the things that you are looking for in the job, right? you know, when you're trying to pick someone who to be a receiver in the NFL, you want to know how well they catch passes. You don't particularly care about, you know, how well they, I don't know, how good their essays are, or we don't ask draftees to write position papers on the slant route, right? See how they, how well they express their feelings about that particular football play. But that seems to be what we're doing here. Like, does it really matter whether they give a snappy answer? In fact, the whole job of being president is not about giving snappy answers. It's about being thoughtful and careful. And so a really fun game that I feel we should play right now is let's imagine what a better, so you know these people. You mean, you know, you're a reporter, like you've met them all the time.
I've met a few.
By the way, can I tell my one story about my connection to one of the candidates?
Please do, yes.
Okay. So my mom is Jamaican. My parents lived in Jamaica for many years. Kamala Harris, her dad, Jamaican. And I went on Google once and noticed that her dad was from the same little town in Jamaica where my mom went to high school. So I emailed him. I was like, "Dear Professor Harris," because he's a professor of economics at Stanford. "I just, you don't know me, but I noticed you're from Brownstown. My mom went to school in Brownstown. What a funny coincidence." He emails back, "Mr. Gladwell, not only am I aware that your mom went to school in Brownstown, and I would see the school was St. Hilda's. I would see the St. Hilda's girls going to church every Saturday morning. I'm sure I saw your mom. But when I went to do my undergraduate work at the University of West Indies in Kingston, I didn't know what I wanted to study, and I decided to choose to take a mathematics course, which led to my getting a PhD in economics, because there was a professor at the University of West Indies who encouraged me to study math, and that professor was, ... your father."
Oh.
So if Kamala wins, I'm gonna say, Kamala's not around if Kamala's mom doesn't meet Kamala's dad, and Kamala's mom doesn't meet Kamala's dad unless he goes to Stanford, and he doesn't go to Stanford unless he studies economics, and he doesn't study economics without my dad. So I'm sorry, Gladwells are gonna be the reason if she wins. I'm very excited about this. Anyway, that's just my, she has to win for me to really truly dine out on this story, so I've, fingers crossed, vote for Kamala. But no, let's figure out, so clearly the debate, bad idea, crazy. Let's come up with better idea. Do you have any better suggestions?
I do not.
Okay.
I do not.
I thought about this. Let me start. So what about this? What about, I'm going to give a serious one and a not so serious one. Mm-hmm. The not so serious one is sort of intrigues me. What are we interested in when it comes? So these people are, these are strangers, right? And right now the whole notion of the electoral season is based on the completely erroneous premise that we can get to know a stranger over the next couple months and make an extraordinarily important determination in that period, which is whether they are fit to be president of the United States. And everything that I have come to believe after writing this book suggests to me that that is a fool's errand. So let's do a better job. One thing that would be really fun to do would be to give them really hard, complex, real-world problems. So we say to them, let's imagine we construct a scenario about a foreign policy crisis in 2022 involving, name two countries. And we lay it all out to them, and we say, how would you deal with that? You have 6 hours, and you need to send us a videotape in 6 hours of you giving a 20-minute presentation on how you intend to deal with this crisis. We put all the answers online. So they have 6 hours. They can consult whoever they want. They're asked to formulate a thoughtful response, and we can judge them. That's a very real-world scenario where they would be presented with a crisis that they need to respond to quickly. And what we want to know is, do they think well under time pressure? Can they put together an effective team of advisors who can help them? And can they communicate effectively to the American people under those circumstances, right? That seems to me, and then we play the videos, right? And we give them 5 different scenarios, one a week for 5 weeks until we have a library for every candidate. And you go home in the leisure of your of your evening, and you look at all of the videos, and then you make it a... Here's my other idea. The other idea is sort of a lot more trivial and frivolous, but I think also useful. I really want to know how they play certain games.
Like while you were talking, I was thinking escape room?
No, I was thinking Scrabble. In my experience, Scrabble is enormously revelatory. At least it is in the Gladwell family. And so the idea of splitting them up into groups of four and having them play extended games of Scrabble, which are all videotaped and live streamed. And I want to know, like, everyone's talking about Joe Biden's fitness. I'm sorry, if he can't do well in Scrabble, I'm going to worry about his fitness. If all of his words are like four letters long and he has like no double word scores, I'm going to be like, Joe, like, this is a demanding job. You just scored like 25 on your Scrabble. Like, this is a problem, right? We're going to talk. I don't know. I just think that would be useful.
I'd love to get to some audience questions before we have to wrap. One of them is about the cultural divide. In a polarized American climate, someone asks, how can Talking to Strangers, your book, help us to approach others and otherness and close the divide?
How can that help us?
How can your book essentially help us close the divide between disparate groups here in this country?
Only in a sense that my book alerts you to the potential for misunderstanding and alerts you to the dangers of overconfidence in your judgments of others. So I guess I would say that the first thing you ought to ask yourself if you perceive yourself to be in disagreement with someone is, do I actually disagree with them or do I simply misunderstand them? And I always thought, I've said this many times now, that when I look at Twitter, at least 75% of the disputes on Twitter are not disputes, they're misunderstandings. They're just people just haven't bothered to figure out what the other person's saying. And then they go off and off on some like long. And this book just says, look, misunderstanding happens all the time, and that should lead you to slow down and then being humble about, you know, if it is really hard to draw a good conclusion about a stranger, then you should be cautious, super cautious.
Someone wanted to know, if you weren't an author, would you likely have been a psychologist?
No, I always wanted to be a real estate developer. And I still kind of want to be a real estate developer, but I'm locked in to being a journalist now. I just always thought, even as a kid, I was like, the idea of being able to build buildings and like look at them for the rest of your life and say, I built that is kind of great. I mean, I wouldn't want to be a real estate developer like some real estate developers, but.
Someone wanted to know, what is the easiest way we can avoid misunderstanding or create a framework for understanding in communications with new people?
Well, I think it's really important for us to limit our intake of information to the things that are relevant. So this is a little pet peeve of mine that I've been obsessed with for a while now, and that is that I no longer believe in job interviews. I think that they're just opportunities for misunderstanding and misapprehension. So why you need to ask yourself, if you're hiring somebody, before you decide to bring them in for the face-to-face interview, what exact information am I gathering from the face-to-face interview that is actually helping me in this job decision, right? So, for example, academics always do the job talk, where you're a graduate student, you're looking to get a job somewhere, and they fly you in, and they line up a bunch of grad students and professors, and they make you give this incredibly high stakes, you know, 45-minute talk on your whatever you're working on. And it's kind of absurd when you think about it, because what you're doing is you're judging someone's ability or capacity, aptitude for being a professor, which is a job that explicitly does not involve high-stakes presentations, by giving them a high-stakes presentation. Think about it. You become a professor because you don't believe in deadlines. You don't want to be... legitimately, you don't want to be judged on what comes out of your mouth in the moment. You want to go and think about it for 6 months and rewrite it 70 times, and that's what you want to be judged on. So in that environment, which is great. We want people who are think that way to be academics. So how do we pick them? We make it like a reality show, and we have them show up and do the exact thing that they are not, that they entered that field to avoid, right? Mm. It's madness. So don't meet them. In fact, there's one, the Princeton philosophy department does adhere to this rule. They do not meet the people they hire. They simply read their philosophy papers. And I desperately wanted to talk to someone from the philosophy department about this practice, and I called them up, and none of them would meet with me. Which I thought was so genius. It was okay. Like, of course, they don't want to meet with me. Why would they? They've read my stuff and have found me, you know, to be completely unworthy of their time and attention.
Okay, well, I'll wrap on this. How does it feel to have been quoted in a Macklemore song?
Well, pretty good. Although, if I can be greedy for a moment, I would rather have been quoted in a, you know, JC song or Eminem. Or, you know, I mean, if you're going to go down that road and you're going to open me up to the possibility that hip-hop artists are going to quote me, I'm going to set my aspirations higher than Macklemore.
Zing. Okay. Well, hey, 10,000 hours is kind of, it's,
no, I mean,
it's in the popular
culture
now because of you.
You know, like, a man can dream.
Certainly. Well, Malcolm Gladwell, thank you so much for being here on Writers on a New England Stage. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
The Music Hall's executive producer is Patricia Lynch. New Hampshire Public Radio's interim executive director is Mark Kaplan, and NHPR's digital and broadcast producer is Sarah Plourd. The Music Hall production manager is Jana Morris. The Music Hall live sound and recording engineer is Ian Martin. Musical director and band tonight are Bob Lord and Dreadnought. The Music Hall literary coordinator is Brittany Wasson, and I'm Peter Biello. Thanks again for coming to Writers on the New England Stage.